Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today for the Transgressors Memorial Service, remembering those who have transgressed against the great spirit of inclusion and must forever be cast into the abyss of dead names. Let's join Brother Andrew remembering those who we have lost.
Our first remembrance is for the University of Colorado at Boulder after they engaged in a blatant act of food racism. Recently, two students at UCB, Urmi Bhattacharya and Aditya Prakash, sued the university for racial discrimination and won a $200,000 settlement. It all began when Prakash used a community microwave on campus to heat up his palak paneer for lunch, and a university staff member complained about the smell and told Prakash he was in violation of a rule against nuking foods with strong odors. Prakash challenged the rule, denied it even existed, and asked why meat sandwiches would be allowed, but his curry was prohibited. Both he and Urmi subsequently experienced rude comments and an escalating pattern of retaliation, including the loss of their academic advisors in the anthropology department, their research funding, and ultimately their teaching positions. And yes, I know for some of you, this one hurts a little because you've long assumed that anything done in Boulder would automatically be in line with our holy cause of wokeness. But this only goes to prove that anyone, anywhere, anytime, even in Boulder, might find themselves on the wrong side of the arc of the justice universe. But it absolutely did happen, and the mental anguish and psychological trauma of being told that the food of your ancestors is too smelly for other people, usually Caucasians, of course, is a part of the systemic pattern of white supremacy culture we're trying to eradicate. Now, I assume some of you might be wondering if there isn't a tension between our position on offensive smells and our position on offensive words. We cancel words all the time that are unhurtful to most people, but which trigger certain individuals. So why wouldn't offensive odors be similarly the fault of the inconsiderate reheater rather than the overly sensitive smeller? After all, if offendedness is in the ear of the behearer, why isn't malodorousness in the nose of the besniffer? And certainly when people have allergies, we want to cater to their sensitivities instead of to the vast majority of people who don't have, for instance, a peanut disability or a perfume disorder. And it's true that all of this analysis might make you think we'd side with those complaining about the smell, until you remember one key fact, the race of those involved. The people causing the smells have brown skin, and the people complaining about the smells have white skin, and that is ultimately all that matters. Even though strong odors can be very triggering, we never count the triggeration of an oppressor class member, and in this case, like so many other similar examples of food aroma racism, defending the bland nasal palate of the pale-skinned complainer literally reeks of racism and ethnic discrimination. Why does the white man get to expect the campus break room to smell like his house instead of the Indian men being allowed to make it smell like their house? That double standard definitely doesn't pass the sniff test. So up with the reheating of ethnic foods and their pungent rejection of colonialist whiff tests. Bring on the kimchi and the doenjang, the stinky tofu and the durian, the lutefisk or the surströmming. Reheat your sauerkraut and your lemony white fish, and always feel free to microwave your Brussels sprouts, and by all means, create as much secondhand curry smoke as you like. It's time to bring Whitey to his knees with his biggest physical vulnerability, his overly sensitive nose. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend!
Second, we definitely want to celebrate a trend we're seeing in the American workplace toward what's called peanut butter raises. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the term, a peanut butter raise is what they call it when a company takes the total amount of money available for salary increases and spreads it evenly across all employees like a slice of bread with peanut butter, presumably creamy, not crunchy, so that everyone benefits equally as opposed to the more traditional approach of rewarding people based on merit or evaluations or something unequal that stinks of judgmentalism, ableism, and prepare yourself, capitalism. According to compensation firm PayScale, nearly half of all American organizations are either already using, planning to start using, or considering the use of these peanut butter raises, whereas the other half of companies plan to keep using so-called merit-based raises. And obviously, you can see why we think this is a wonderful evolution. First, it's just plain easier. From a purely practical point of view, this eliminates all the wasted time, effort, and cost of having some people evaluate the performance of other people. If you aren't going to have to pay people based on performance, then you don't have to spend so much time calculating performance, right? Just think how much money will be available for pay raises if you simply don't waste so much of it figuring out who deserves it. Also, I think we can all relate to the hurtfulness of performance reviews and especially the anguish of not receiving as much of a raise or bonus as someone else based merely on something as mean as differential productivity. Do we really believe it's acceptable for one human being to assess the worth of another human being and then to say one is worth more than another entirely because they happen to do more work or do the same work with a higher quality? Of course not. How totally ableist, not to mention cruel. Is it Henry's fault that Jeff builds widgets faster or has sales numbers more? Of course not. As the dictates of Marxism-Leninism teach us, all people always do their very best regardless of reward, which is why rewarding them equally makes all the sense in the world. It's not as if people respond to financial incentives and do more to earn more, right? If you eliminate the incentives, those who do more will continue to do more, and those who do less will continue to do their best. If our primary goals and economic structure of our society are to make people feel included and validated, to be proud of themselves for no reason whatsoever, and to have the high self-esteem that is every person's Gaia-given right, then by gum, we shouldn't only give everyone the same raise, we should really be paying them all the same salary as well. Talk about a great way to eliminate envy and pride and shame and the pain of seeing some people as better than others. What a wonderful world of lived equality that we can bring about if only more people would follow the pattern. We say income equality for all. Long live the beautiful prosperity that can only be achieved by taking away everyone's actual reason for doing anything productive. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
And finally, the day is here at last, and the formal report by the Standing Non-Symmetrical Committee on Language Irregularities and Other Matters of Justice and Minutia has arrived. And we have the long-anticipated guidance for the use of pronouns for pets. That's right, the bitterly contested issue of whether to refer to our animal companions as male and female without their consent or input has been settled, and the answer is so elegantly obvious. Since we all know that humans can have gender identities that don't match their bodies, we recognize that transgender people should be referred to with the pronouns that match their internal belief about their gender instead of the pronouns that match their external bodies. But if humans can be transgender, obviously so can cats, dogs, parakeets, goldfish, and the occasional gerbil. But of course, we have a problem in that guinea pigs, angelfish, and even schnauzers and Abyssinians have no effective way of telling us which gender they really are, and so what should we do? Some dogs who lift the leg, well, might actually be girls inside. And some dogs who squat, most certainly, are really boys. And although some cats identified male at birth have feminine meows but still identify as male, whereas others use their feminine meow to express their transgender status, how can we tell the difference? Worse still, what if we call here boy to a testiculated terrier who thinks of herself as a catcher instead of a pitcher? And if we try to reward an obedient uterus-owning retriever with a gentle, who's a good girl, how do we know we aren't gender-shaming him with our assumptions in the process? We can't. And that's why the Standing Non-Symmetrical Committee has announced that, because of the possibility of any of our animal babies being transgender, we must avoid even the chance of misgendering them at all costs, and henceforth refer to them with gender-neutral pronouns on the assumption that they might be trans, or even non-binary, or gender-fluid, or in the case of bulldogs, gender-slobbering. In addition, the committee is advising that all pet names should henceforth at least be gender ambiguous so as to avoid the bias that comes from an overtly gendered pet name. So no more Rex and Butch and Max and Teddy and Rocky. Also, no more Daisy and Lola and Lady and Lucy and Bella. Just as it would be wrong to risk dead gendering a Molly by naming her Molly, it is wrong to do anything which risks imposing your own ideas about the gender of a snake or a turtle or a ferret upon that poor creature without their consent. Now, all pets will be they-thems, and if your little girl poodle doesn't want to wear that pink tutu, don't force the issue. She might actually be a he. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
And now, brethren, sistren, and otheren, having been cleansed of these hurtful words, give each other the holy virtue signal, and go forth and transgress no more.